I'm William Shutkin.
And I'm Andy Bush.
And I'm Devin Bertram.
Welcome to the Sustainable City Show, a new podcast where we discuss bold ideas and innovations for green, equitable, and climate-friendly cities with the people making them happen.
Welcome back, Andy and Dev. Great to be with you both again.
Hi, how are you?
Hello.
Hi, great to see you both. Last time we talked, or really we speculated, about the future of work in the post-pandemic climate age. We talked about office space and commuting patterns. These changes are happening in real time before our very eyes. Well, the same can be said about the future of cities writ large, not just office buildings and commutes, but cities as a whole: housing, transportation, retail space, parks, institutions, all seem to be in a state of flux at best, crisis at worst. I think of housing, of course, in our major urban centers, not just our so-called star cities, but lesser ones too. Are we in a temporary part of the cycle or the beginning of a bigger transition? An evolutionary leap. And what does that mean for cities of different sizes and cultures? Coastal, heartland, red, blue, and so on. Where do politics fit in? And what about the so-called urban doom loop? Hype or reality? Let's talk about these things and about the cities we think will thrive going forward and those that might struggle, the sink or swim of our urban future.
The three of us have worked in urban development, in cities for a collective, 100 years or so?
And maybe not. That's just me.
A little shy of that.
All right, definitely a little shy. Definitely not you alone, Andy. Sorry, I was unnecessarily aging us collectively. Anyway, so it'd be really fun. Let's shoot this breeze talking about the future of the city. You know, maybe work is a part of it. Commuting patterns, the fate of office space, but maybe we expand that to talk about other things like housing and transportation and parks and retail space and the like. Given the pretty dramatic shifts we've experienced, certainly since the pandemic, but more generally, the last couple of decades, really the flight, right, of most of the planet to cities. About 80% of us across the planet live in cities or in metro areas, the inverse of where we lived and worked 100 years ago, rural to urban. So what's on the top of your minds, Dev and Andy, as you think about the future of cities and the work that you're doing and the lives that you're living these days? What's top of mind about cities?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about cities today, and we have been talking a lot about work, but I'm starting to think more about cities as a whole, and that it's been my professional career. But there's a part of me that's really starting to question the validity of cities, or at least downtown cores, as we've known them. I know we're urbanizing globally, but my question is starting to be, urbanizing toward what in terms of the core? What are the things that people are going to get in exchange for that bargain of moving into an urban area? So I'd love to talk a little bit today about both the upsides of cities and the places I still love, but what are some of the things beyond just work that maybe we're starting to question or we need some more emphasis on when we think about that? How about you, Deb?
I can echo that, Andy. A couple things. One, I mean, cities just provide such an implication, an opportunity to support smart transportation, impacts to climate change, and just how we're creating supportive communities. And I've been thinking about, you know, to William's statistic earlier, in terms of over 50% of humans are living in cities by 2050. I think 70 or 75% will be moving to cities. And I think accommodating that is going to be a challenge. But I think we also have a different expectation of cities, kind of to Andy, what you were saying is how do we, what are the cities that we want to create? If we're not relying on them to work and to have our office space to commute to, what does the city look like and how is it providing for us? And what are those attributes, both from a personal level and a community level and a professional level?
Yeah, and I would say as someone who's been traveling around a lot lately, looking at cities and the neighborhoods around them, I would say that, or urban cores in the neighborhood around them, I feel like the neighborhoods are pretty safe. I worry about the urban cores And I feel like we're going through a really big transformation and we're being hit by 5 or 10 different major things at the same time, from the nature of online retail to changes in transportation to changes in technology and how people get together and aggregate. I think we're going to look back on this as kind of a great transformation of urban cores.
Yeah, definitely agree. And I think that's, there's so many characteristics lately that are coming up, but you mentioned safety, and that feels like, I think cities feel like they have go through different periods and where, you know, being safe or unsafe. And maybe I'm thinking about my East Coast upbringing and being near New York. And that was the city that I went to and lived in for a good while as well. And there were times and periods and areas of New York that were not safe. And then there were periods where it felt completely safe and sort of the community and city habitants took care of one another. And so it just is interesting to see how cities are navigating that safety piece among all these other characteristics that you mentioned, Danny.
I think I agree with, and everything you've said resonates with me. I'm thinking of what's proved to be sort of the permanence of cities as a form, a way of humans living on the planet. And so we have, you know, over time, going back thousands and thousands of years, as we moved out, you know, from the savannah and from a state of hunting and gathering, we congregated for all sorts of reasons. I remember in college, my medieval history professor talking about this wonderful notion that ideas always followed the merchants. And merchants went and traveled to trade, and they tended to travel to populated places where there were goods and services to be bought and sold. And with those merchants and that commerce came all sorts of ideas about how to improve life for humans, and if not necessarily the planet as a whole. So I don't see, you know, cities going anywhere. This goes to what we've been reading about the last year or two, the urban doom loop, right? That cities are going to lose population, they're going to lose tax base, they're going to lose services and quality of life, and the apocalypse. I don't buy into that at all. But I do buy into and appreciate the notion that, as I think both of you are suggesting, the city dweller of today, especially in this country, but really across the globe. In fact, there was just recently a report I saw in the last couple of days listing the top, did either of you see it? The top 10 or 20 cities, maybe it was Forbes or Fortune magazine. Yeah. Not a single US city made the list in terms of quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of the usual suspects. But I do think the city dweller around the globe is looking for more from the city than just work, economic opportunity, you know, some good restaurants and access to material goods. I'm particularly excited by the idea that we're reimagining cities almost like resorts, almost like amenity destinations. This idea that the city of the 21st century, whether it's New York or Copenhagen or Mumbai, is a place where you can go experience wild nature. Mm-hmm. A place where you can, you know, go kayaking, a place where you can plant a garden or an urban farm and indeed commercialize it and sell produce as if you were an agricultural producer, you know, in the Hudson River Valley as opposed to downtown Manhattan. So I think what's really interesting is this sort of confluence, the coming together of all the great things about cities, from architecture to transit to food and culture to jobs and ideas, with all of the great things of our rural and even wilderness areas.
See, just to make it a little interesting, I think that's a little utopian, and I love the way you're describing it. I'm not sure I quite buy it in that, to take the kind of other side, the merchants have all gone online. the restaurants deliver with DoorDash, Google can put us all in a room together from 10 different places and make it feel as real as the conference room you used to congregate in. You can live in the neighborhoods around or away from the city, at least the urban core, cheaper. I don't know that that bodes well for the urban core.
Well, so that's sort of my point. To the extent that historically cities were really about commerce, and therefore on this argument, the exchange of things beyond just commercial goods and services, but ideas about science, about culture, the great universities, whether, you know, in the West, in Bologna, or starting there and then spreading out to all the other great Western centers, capitals. To the extent, Andy, what you're saying has real truth to it, that it's no longer about physical commerce and, you know, caravans of merchants moving from city A to city B. I think the city has to have additional kinds of value to offer the people who actually want to live there and pay taxes there. Dev, to your point, right? And one of the big things that historically cities have lacked, you know, Lewis Mumford's The Industrial City of the 19th Century was the, you know, the dirtiest place in the history of human civilization, are cleaner, greener experiences for all, right? So it's access to parks, it's seeing seals and oysters reintroduced to, you know, New York Harbor, or the killer whales of Vancouver. It's being able to have that quality of life, that outdoor/environmental experience, among other experiences, that I think is sort of the next value proposition for the world's great cities. It's no longer, hey, this is, you know, it's Wall Street, it's Madison Avenue, it's, you know, London or some other great commercial center. It's what else, you know, do you have for me today?
Cities had a why for the last 50 years that we've embraced. I wonder, Deb, what you think the new why is.
I agree with William. I think the why is, I guess I would lean more on community and connection. I was thinking about cities and, you know, how much I feel I get a sense of a city in regards to looking at the streets and how, what is the activity in the streets, or what is the lack of activity in the streets? And that feels like that provides the buzz and connection, and where people congregate is sort of first in the streets, and then they might move to a cafe or a business or stroll in the park. And I think the why of cities is, yeah, generating that that community.
And how do we do
in a diverse way? I don't know. It feels like, again, there's more opportunity and expectation of cities than there have been, and possibility than there have been in the past. Not easy, but it feels like there's sort of a new playground to consider.
And what do you think of that?
You know, I agree. I'm playing the antagonist just because I've been traveling cities a lot in the last month in the U.S. And I think the U.S. is kind of oftentimes a harbinger of where things are going from an urban planning standpoint. And we can always, you know, I'm often saying in my work, we can look at Europe and they've been doing it for 10 years, whatever it is to be in the sustainability world. I'm a little worried that U.S. cities were, as we talked about before, from an office standpoint, kind of quite hollow, and that lack of diversity as it does in nature is catching up with them, and that we're in this big transition that I don't know where it's going. The optimist in me says we can, the next 40 or 50 years are going to be really exciting and transformative, and there's great opportunity. The pessimist in me says, at least core urban areas in bigger cities. I'm not so worried about 100,000 population cities. I'm more worried about 3 to 10 million person cities, that their urban cores are in for a rough ride for the next 3 or 4 decades.
Mm-hmm. I agree that that is a possibility. I'm hoping it's not for all the larger cities.
Me too.
But I think it is that we're at that interesting intersection in terms of how or where is this, which way is this city going to go, or these urban cores going to go? And it may be sort of taking that path down to the not ideal route and then circling back. And that's what's interesting to me too, is thinking, you know, how long does this take? You know, we talked about this transition, or are we like at the beginning of this transition and the middle of it? And how much time can our citizens endure?
My guess is we're at the very beginning, which is a little frightening.
And what do you think is the time scale of this change or evolution, Andy, that you're...
You know, the pessimist in me says 40 or 50 years. The optimist in me says when you really are struggling, you can make amazing change. And very quickly. And so that's the optimist in me. And I'd say the other thing is, as you follow things like AI development here in the last 6 months, it's changed so fast that it's mind-boggling even to people that are in that business how quickly it has changed. So the, you know, I can see both sides of it. What I see this almost as a phenomenon where we've kind of pushed people out from the center core in a theoretical way. And the neighborhoods are actually still quite vibrant. And obviously a lot of suburban areas have become quite vibrant. And I think there will be an equal reaction to kind of rebuild from those edges back into the core.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think some of the drivers of perhaps more dramatic change, Andy, might be? Is it affordability and housing? Is it the unhoused and homelessness, which, you know, at least in this country, but in other cities and nations around the planet, you know, these are also great challenges that are forcing the hands of policymakers and citizens more generally to really focus on these issues. What are those some of the things that might get us to where we need to be faster?
I think I was in San Francisco last week, and I think it may be, you know, again, a bit of a harbinger in that it reminds me, I think it was Mark Twain, right, who said the reports of my death have been significantly exaggerated. I forget the exact words.
Yeah.
But I feel that way about San Francisco. It's got some real issues, and it's quite obvious in specific areas. There's other parts of the city that still feel wonderfully vibrant and safe and comfortable. And I think that San Francisco dealing with unhoused and dealing with some of the issues that they have that leadership really in the city is going to have to adjust, and I think maybe is starting to do, will be one of those major kind of trends or impetus. I think in San Francisco, you know, buildings that used to sell or be worth $1,000 a square foot being sold for $300 a foot, you know, kind of fundamental economic changes that create opportunities for redevelopment and change. I think those are also, and you know, that's going to be another big thing across the country, is just the economics of real estate.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the model projects, Anne, that you saw on your recent Urban Land Institute tour? Anything that in your mind is in fact sort of a harbinger, good or ill, of the future of cities?
I don't know good or ill, but I'll give three examples. One was, there was a wonderful, affordable, permanently supportive project down in kind of the south of the ballpark.
And Mission Bay?
Yeah, it was essentially part of Mission Bay, and actually in the core, and it was in a place you wouldn't expect, because Mission Bay has been a pretty high-end development, and it was wonderful to see a really well-designed, well-created, permanently supportive housing project integrated into the fabric there. I'd say another one was going to Fremont in Seattle and seeing a neighborhood that, you know, I forget the old saying for Fremont, but it was one of the funkiest neighborhoods in Seattle. And it's now one of the most energized, exciting, interesting neighborhoods. I mean, it's always been a fun neighborhood, but it's one of the great neighborhoods in Seattle right now.
And I think the best Pilsner in the U.S. Fremont's Golden Pilsner. Jenna and I went to the brewery there last summer, and it was so good. And now I buy it religiously.
I'd say the third was the Google Bayview campus. 5,000 people working in two buildings with its own infrastructure and essentially neighborhoods of recreation, open space, restaurants, and workspace. You know, that's probably as many people that historically have worked in downtown Boulder, where we're from. So
a small city kind of within a city.
Yeah. And those three, I would say, were kind of the extremes of what I saw, all of which gave me hope. And
sounds like it.
Yeah. Each experience in different
despite your impulse to the contrary.
Yeah. No, they were all really interesting to see at different scales. And they all gave me hope in different ways for the future of neighborhoods, the future of addressing affordable housing and permanently supportive housing and the social changes that will come with that, to the future of work that is changing in ways that I don't think most of us yet understand, including me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm reflecting on Andy's thought about kind of the fringe neighborhoods supporting the urban core, kind of coming around and sort of being smaller models for the larger urban core. And it just makes me think of the goal or impetus for 15-minute cities and really having this accessibility.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep going. I was just thinking the same thing.
Yeah. I think it's just the last few years. And, you know, I think we talked about workplace last time, but I think in all regard, the last few years, we kind of saw everything shut down or break down and realized, okay, what do I want and need in a more immediate vicinity? And are looking for that now, you know, even as things continue to open up and streets do become more lively and businesses are open or workplaces are open and so forth. It's sort of this now, there's more options, it feels like, but yeah. Seems like we don't want to let that go.
Well, that's where that's where I'm so fundamentally optimistic. I think the threats/drivers include things like land consumption, natural resource harm, vehicle miles travel. The idea that we know we need to get off the auto dime. And we also recognize that we, in this country and around the world, spent the last 60, 70 years designing, you know, our human habitat around the internal combustion engine, the automobile. And I think the simple revelation, understanding that we need to shift, and in some ways, you know, retrofit and go retro more generally, like move back in time pre-automobile, but with all of the benefits of the technology, the know-how, the policy innovation that we have at our disposal today. And that's where I'm so optimistic. I think this idea that, you know, just because 80%, 75% of US residential land is exclusively zoned for single family, doesn't mean we can't begin to, you know, disaggregate and parse some of that and begin to build multifamily and put retail and commercial and or office space in what were, you know, for the last 100 years, exclusive single family districts. Likewise, you know, our industrial zones, and so much, Andy, of what you just described in San Francisco, these are former industrial areas that over the last 20, 30 years have been reimagined, replanned. And now we're dropping, you know, entire new neighborhoods, some of them anchored, as you suggest, by companies like Google, tech companies, into these formerly blighted industrial zones. Think of, you know, Hunter's Point and all the incredible inclusive redevelopment that's going on there and will be going on for some time. So to me, it's like, it's all about this great or grand, not so much transformation, but like retrofit. How do we retrofit downtowns? How do we move off the notion that there's like one downtown core, but instead there are multiple downtown cores in any given city? Even the idea in the suburbs, right? New York metro suburbs that have rediscovered their downtowns. And now see people wanting to actually live in a downtown suburban city or town versus, you know, the 1 acre plot a few miles outside of the downtown area. So I think it's a big retrofit. And like any retrofit, it's super complicated, hard, expensive. It takes a lot of policy innovation, technology innovation. But whether it's a plan to reclaim, you know, a paved over wetland for the purposes of restoring a fishery, or reclaiming, you know, old industrial lands and brownfields for a new mixed use, you know, mixed income neighborhood. Like, to me, that's the most interesting, exciting stuff there is, and bodes really well, I think, for the future of cities.
Yeah, I mean, the optimist in me, and one of the other projects we saw was a bioswale project in Seattle in the Fremont neighborhood that gave me hope for really modest but extremely important urban open space opportunities and connections that have a connection to kind of the fundamental infrastructure component of treating water in this case or others. Yeah. The optimist in me sees, as you say, this large-scale retrofit with prices coming down substantially for certain types of urban real estate. And if someone was, if it was an enlightened public-private partnership, city government and private sector, you could, I don't know that you'll see the Central Parks of the world, but you could see this wonderful knitting together of a string of open spaces and a change zoning that supports and potentially finances much of that open space with a much more diverse mix of new buildings that reflect this transformation toward the future, where much, if not most, of retailing is online. Restaurants need to be aggregated in certain sub neighborhoods. More people need to live in urban areas, and office has been completely redefined. And that's done through well-planned incremental retrofits and or the occasional large-scale retrofit here or there, although I'm more a fan of smaller things coming together in a complex way than kind of one-dimensional things done by individual large developers.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see, because I agree, I see a lot of public support, political will for reclaiming urban land for green space, for open space, for productive ecosystem services, you know, oyster beds and Manhattan Island. Given your financial, especially real estate financial acumen, what's the financial model for that reclamation? Is it purely public finance and bonds and, you know, taxpayers agreeing to tax themselves to do this? Or is there some other creative mechanism to ensure that we do this at a scale that's really meaningful, especially for climate?
I think it's a combination of thinking of open space as an amenity and also starting to think of it as infrastructure, but rethink it. I mean, open space has always been infrastructure in cities, but I think we kind of lost sight of that. And I think that, you know, cities like Seattle are doing interesting floor area bonuses, so you get an extra floor for doing X, Y, or Z. So I don't know that there's going to be lots of capital running around for these kinds of projects. I think it's going to have to be more based on political will and creative minds. But I'd be interested, like, Devin, how do you think about that when you've seen San Francisco a lot? How would you do that in a place like San Francisco or Denver?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to that public-private partnership piece, because it feels like that's rallying the benefits that both sides can bring, both the financial and the community or political piece. And it also kind of distributes accountability across different stakeholders. And I think that can really help carry solutions forward. I agree, though, it takes some creativity and imagination. And I think the finance piece is going to be a challenge, but nothing that can't be overcome.
there's a wonderful documentary that's available now on Prime Video about the late great editor Bob Gottlieb and Bob Caro, the writer. And Gottlieb just died, what, 2 weeks ago at 92, former editor of The New Yorker, Simon & Schuster, Alfred Knopf, just an amazing human. And Caro, of course, whose fame started with his great book, The Power Broker, about, I'm just blanking, help me out, Jane Jacobs' nemesis.
The New York.
Bob Moses. Bob Moses. Right. And Caro, who basically then went on to write about Lyndon Johnson and is all about studying power and people who wield power for good or for bad. But this idea that, you know, people like Moses, and we have others, God, Richard Ravitch just died, the great New York City civic leader who did so much to turn New York City around the last 50 years as a kid growing up in the suburbs of New York. You know, it's just his name became a household name because as an individual with a lot of skills and generally, you know, good intentions, he was able to make a big difference in the fate of the city. So I'm wondering, you know, is part of this about the kinds of civic leaders we see emerging in America's and other great cities around the world who really do have a vision and the skill set to be able to make that vision, you know, a reality? I mean, Andy and Deb, I'm thinking of our own wonderful local mayor here in Boulder, our friend Aaron Brockett, who I'm happy to say is going to run again for mayor, and who's sort of in his soft-spoken but very studied and thoughtful way is really helping make pretty dramatic changes in our little city of Boulder, Colorado, if you think about it. Right, and Deb?
I would agree. I mean, I think that there's an opportunity, and I consider Aaron to be one of them. I think there's an opportunity for the new visionary, and I think that crisis creates opportunity, as people talk about it. And I think there, when prices are a third of what they might have been, when prices are always going up, it's very difficult to get people to pay attention to a collective view and to band together or make sacrifices for a greater good that may also benefit them from an enlightened self-interest perspective. But when everything's going up, it's a little hard to get in that mindset. When, you know, I used to have an accountant who used to say, you can't fall off the floor. I think when you get to a certain point, you're willing to work with others, be more creative, give up something, whether it's open space or others, to be part of a bigger vision that you believe will be collectively better for everyone, including yourself in the future. And that may be what we find is some great urban visionaries coming out of this kind of crisis/opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Andy, I agree. And I love that because I think it's optimistic. And it also makes me think about that question you asked earlier about what is the why of cities? I think, you know, individual cities having that why or that vision is encouraging, and it sort of begins to gather, you know, individuals and community and support to push that vision forward. I do go to the place though, like, oh, why do we have to be so low and be in such a low place to reach that point or to reach out a hand or be more creative and more imaginative and stretch and collaborate more? And it's, yeah, I'd like to think that we could do it at all levels, but I think we're pushed more when we are in a more drastic, hard place.
And if you think about it, though, at least in the U.S. context, and I think this applies to other cities in the developed world, it wasn't so much, and that things were low. Well, interest rates were low, but it was the fact that especially housing and property values in star cities and first tier cities and increasingly in second and third tier cities, that housing, that most basic, you know, Maslowian need, down there, you know, pretty low on the hierarchy of needs, got so crazy and expensive this last decade. to me, that's kind of the paradox here. It was the fact that we were kind of the victims of our own success with so much cheap money and people seeing the value of their property, those who own property, you know, skyrocket, and I guess feeling pretty good about it. But some of them, right, are held captive by it. They can't afford to sell the place because there's nowhere else for them to go, even to, you know, cash out. So in some ways, it's precisely our relative success of the last decade that have caused this unprecedented shelter crisis. And we see it not only with young people, you know, 20s and 30s, who might not have an independent source of wealth, or might not be, you know, a Google engineer or hedge fund manager in their 20s or 30s. Pretty much everyone else is trying to figure out where the hell are they going to live? How do they live in a way that's not rent burdened, where they're paying, you know, well above a third of their gross monthly on shelter, to say nothing of food, transit, transportation, et cetera. I think that generation, including my own children, our children, you know, Andy, yours and mine, to the extent we've got 20 somethings, is forcing, you know, policymakers, folks perhaps more senior in age, to really take seriously this question, like where is this rising generation going to live? And many of them, many of our elected leaders, you know, their own children fall in this category. So I do think that the chickens are coming home to roost, the kids are coming home to roost, perhaps literally, because they're living in their parents' basement. And I do think that's forcing a lot of creative and you know, sort of powerful thinking on the part of mayors, city councils, planning boards, big and small, to say, God, how do we rethink what it means to live in Boulder or San Francisco, and to build and to develop? And how do we remove some of those barriers, which for so long have made it so hard to redevelop and reimagine our cities, because it's simply not allowed?
I think for the last decade, in most cities around the country, we've been focused on the housing crisis. And I think it's seemed a little one-dimensional, and it's kind of created sides. I think we're at the point where we have a housing crisis, we have an office crisis, we have a retail crisis, we have a restaurant crisis, and we have a transportation crisis and a finance crisis. And I think that folks who thought they knew the answer before are a little more open to different ideas and thoughts, is my hope.
Amen.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't think that, for better or worse, that there's a one solution. You know, I think every city has its own nuances and its own challenges and populations that have different needs or values. I mean, I think that there's perhaps a fundamental needs, talking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, of course, but I think that there's personality of a city shapes what those solutions may be.
I agree.
So that's where the creative piece, I think, continues to be a requirement.
But again, and perhaps the word crisis, you know, is easily overused, but I do sort of agree, Andy, that we do have a constellation of, you know, great challenges, some of them related to housing, to climate, and of course, all of them being connected in one way or another. But I have faith in the rising generation. I mean, one of the things I often say to folks is, you know, change is slow, it does happen, and it often does depend on, you know, sort of one generation giving way to another, which is as simple as people getting older, no longer serving in positions of power, eventually, you know, generations dying off and new ones filling the void. And I think there's an expectation, I certainly see this among my graduate students, like our own producer, Shane Casey, among 20-somethings for whom things like climate change, climate resilience, sustainability, affordability, transit, biking, walking, 15-minute neighborhoods, DoorDash, and online retail, like, you know, they are native to these ideas and concepts.
And they now have the ability, now that these things are more or less mainstream, whereas, you know, when we were growing up and getting educated, they were still pretty fringy slash marginal, them to use and refine and begin to implement in real policy, whether it's zoning rules or tax policy.
I believe in the statement, I don't know who made it, but I've heard it repeated several times, in that things happen a lot slower than you think they should. And then they begin to happen much quicker than you thought they could. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that has to do with generational change.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Totally. And, a global pandemic doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, I think we've tended to look at things, we look for simplicity in life, or we look for an answer. And I think we said there was a pandemic. I'm glad it appears to feel like the worst of it is over. Now let's get back to normal. And in the background, the nature of technology and other things were shifting work. Society was shifting work. This a younger generation was saying, maybe we don't have to work like our parents worked. An older group of people like myself were thinking, maybe we don't have to work like we used to have to work. Mm-hmm. You know, all technology was changing food and transportation and retail, all in the background. And that's why I think we are in this great transformation, that I'm an optimist too, mostly just because it's more fun than being a pessimist.
And, agreed.
And I'm interested in what's to come.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to need to be a lot of different solutions. And I am thinking of them in this conversation sort of in a technology bucket and a people bucket. And I think it's going to require both. And the younger generations, I think, have their hands around both. With AI and thinking about how AI is influencing city operations, and just, you know, I've been learning about digital twin cities and helping planning and so forth. And that's just something that is only accelerating. And I think our younger generation is thirsty for that.
Tell us a little bit about digital twin cities.
There's a literal a digital city, and they do a replica of the physical assets and the interdependencies within the cities to help for urban planning purposes. Dublin and Singapore have them. And then I just read recently that by 2025, they imagine that around 500 cities will have digital twin cities. And it just really helps to kind of play out, or the hope is that it can help play out these solutions that I don't know if we've had that capability in the past. And not that it can necessarily predict the future. I think, you know, the pandemic has certainly taught us that we can't predict that at all. But I think it can give some insights into how different technologies that are being explored can play out across the city.
That takes William and I back to our roots.
That's right. That's right, Ann. Hey, Deb, you know, Andy and I met because Andy was on the board of a foundation that I became president of. The foundation's core value proposition, core offering, was a piece of technology, basically to, you know, digitize the city circa turn of the century and create tools, scenario planning and visualization tools, that would assist people in making better decisions, more sustainable, inclusive decisions about the future of their cities, their communities.
Not unlike digital twins, it was a nonlinear agent-based modeling tool that would create different outcomes given different decisions. And the goal was, as it sounds like it's starting to manifest itself now, to give cities both the ability to explore choices and understand future implications without having to go through that experience. And to, you know, understand whether if you run it 10 times or 100 times, is it a better way to go 90% of the time or something like that? That's kind of fascinating. I'd like to learn more.
Well, in fact, Andy, coincidentally, my virtual background, which our listeners can't see, is my friend Sabra Fields, one of her handful of beautiful, colorful prints of the state of Vermont. In this case, there are windmills, wind turbines on the top of this ridgeline. And as you'll recall, Andy, that was one of the things we designed our digital tool at the foundation to do, which was to put wind turbines virtually on hilltops in Vermont or Colorado so that people could see what they look like and then could calculate things like greenhouse gas emissions or tax revenues and therefore make informed decisions about whether they wanted to see these things built on the top of their mountains or not. And really fascinating. I mean, the other thing to note about AI, talk about optimist and pessimist, is, you know, will ever more sophisticated AI, you know, lead to nuclear disaster or some other Armageddon? Or will it in fact enable folks like my own graduate students are doing, use something like ChatGPT to come up with a state-of-the-art climate resilience plan for a city of 150,000 people in the interior West, subject to floods and wildfires. And in 5 minutes, AI has collated best-in-class climate resilience plans from peer cities and spit out, you know, a workable plan. And maybe it's both and, right?
The real, you know, one of the real answers is maybe, which means we're not sure yet which way it's going to go, or it may
be. We'll see.
And I'd say that, I mean, we're using it, ChatGPT and Bard, for different components of our work to reduce material and labor input and embodied energy. I just saw something come out the other day, and it may not be a first, but it was an early ChatGPT designing a building. And so it was a 20 or 30 story.
Yeah,
I haven't really looked at the details of it yet, but it's interesting, if nothing else.
Think of 3D printing, right? And as that matures as a technology for dramatically lowering costs and speed. Hey, folks, we should wind down. I mean, maybe we should even do a part two because we're just sort of scratching the surface.
I could easily do a part two.
You know, on all of this, the digital city. You know, what I would love to talk about soon is Ed Glaser's notion with his MIT colleague of the playground city. Andy, to your point about
I read that article. I liked it a lot.
You know what?
Yeah, I did as well. That's great.
What happens to downtown cores? Well, let's ask the question, you know, why cities? You're not having to work in the city, or at least in an office in the city. What else can we expect, demand from cities, and how do we make it happen? And again, to me, that's the moment we're in. We're asking really exciting, interesting questions, some of them driven by, you know, real risk like climate and, you know, the complete devaluation of commercial real estate, or at least substantial devaluation. Others of it inspired by serious vision of how we want to spend our time on the planet and in cities.
Well, I'll finish my part for today, in that I do think we should do a part two, and I'll finish as an optimist. I started as a pessimist just to get things moving, but the optimist in me does see this as a transformational time for urban cores in a really positive way, and a transformation of the neighborhoods that surround cities that really is already taking place in the last two or three years. I mean, they've been doing very well in certain cities, but in others, this has been just the boost they needed in a positive way. And I'm intrigued by things like a digital twin city, because I think that in this case, AI and its components allow you to look at many alternative scenarios very quickly. And we've honestly been kind of wandering through the wilderness as we look at sustainable kind of climate change alternatives for cities. So to run many scenarios without having to go through the outcome of a bad decision and explore those, I think is really optimistic for both building consensus around ideas and making the right choices. So I'm finishing in a more excited mode than where I started.
Love it. Deb, what about
glad
you?
Glad to hear it, Andy.
concluding thoughts, which I assume are positive and optimistic.
I'm all for part two as well. And just what I'm reflecting on and wrapping up with is, to your question, William, is that it is, it feels like it is both and a lot of different levels, you know, that it's both technology and people, like looking at the solutions there. I think oftentimes in the past, well, that feels a little too narrow, but we can so often look to technology to create the solutions for moving forward. And I think that it's both technology and people, and we can provide more creative solutions looking at both, or thinking about AI. It's both, you know, can allow us to progress faster and more effectively and efficiently. And I think, you know, it needs its guardrails. So yeah. It's exciting to think about the both and all the topics that we've talked today.
Totally. And to add to that, I think it's equally cart horse, right? I think it's, I think the horse are us, the people. We're deciding what we want this technology to do, whether it's AI or light rail or an office building that we want to now repurpose and convert. And then it's developing technologies to serve those ends versus technology for technology's sake, which I, as you're suggesting, Gab, I do think has sort of been the MO for a long time. So folks, that was super fun. Thanks for another conversation and sort of impromptu get together. Really appreciate it. Shane, thanks as always for your assist as our wonderful producer.
Yeah, thank you, Shane.
And we'll talk very soon, okay?
All right. Thanks all.
Take care.